Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Shubnam Virmani. Our moderator today is none other than Gayathri Ramachandran. Gayathri, thanks so much for being our moderator. I'll actually turn it over to you to introduce Shubnam and get our conversation rolling.
Thank you, Rahul, and it's a great pleasure to introduce Shubnam. So Shubnam Virmani is a documentary filmmaker, a former journalist, a feminist, and singer of Kabir folk songs. In 2003, stung by the horror of the communal riots that had happened in Gujarat, India in 2002, she set out in quest of the 15th century Indian mystic and poet Saint Kabir, exploring how his poetry intersects with the ideas of identity, religion, nationalism, harmony, and impermanence. She ventured into diverse sociocultural, religious, and musical landscapes, meeting with people who sing, love, quote, revere, and make meaning of Kabir in their lives. In 2009, following 6 years of this journey, Shubnam and the Kabir Project team offered to the world a set of 4 musical documentary films and several music CDs and books of translated poetry for reflection and healing. The Kabir Project team has now been engaged for over 15 years and in curating and re-expressing the power of Kabir's poetry through these documentary films, music CDs, and books. In addition, they also hold urban festivals, rural yatras, school workshops, and host a web archive. Their work has been recognized by several awards, including the Special Jury Prize in the 52nd Indian National Film Awards for one of their films, In the Market Stands Kabir. So the journey in search of Kabir in present-day India and Pakistan also had a few unexpected and intangible twists for Shubnam. She was living in Ahmedabad at the time of the communal riots in Gujarat in 2002 and witnessed some of the mob violence firsthand. A line from Kabir at that time flashed into her head, which was basically, "Oh, seekers, see, the world has gone mad." This line had propelled her to seek out the living Kabir folk traditions with the conviction that here was something she had to preach to the violent, misguided ones out there. But over her six-year journey, the magic of Kabir's song and poetry began to slowly seep within and to hold up a transformational mirror to the false lines within her own mind. So to find herself complicit in the social scenario that she had set out to condemn was an unexpected and humbling outcome of her journey. Among the many gifts that the journey brought her, two of them held especially deep personal significance. One was the gift of a guru in the form of Prahlad Tapanyaji, the Kabir folk singer from Malwa, Madhya Pradesh, and the second was the gift of song. Encouraged and guided by Tapanyaji and inspired by the inclusive spirit of folk music, Shubnam now plays the 5-string tambura herself and performs a wide repertoire of folk songs of Kabir and other mystic poets. She's currently working on 2 upcoming books, one on Kabir and another on Shah Abdul Latif Bitai. And she's an artist in residence at the Srishti Institute of Art, Design and Technology in Bangalore. So welcome, Shubnam.
I'm
really excited and grateful that we're in conversation with you today because the Kabir Project films and music also had a pretty deep impact on my life. Really excited.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Okay. So, you know, I wanted to ask you to start off about your relationship to Kabir before you set out on this journey. And, you know, this question is sort of like the context for it is that I've read that you often feel at a loss for words when you're asked, why Kabir? And, you know, and the answer at one point you felt was that Kabir chose you. And while I understand that that might seem like the simplest and most truthful answer to explain, you know, how your life was swept up and changed by this journey in search of Kabir. I wanted to ask what your relationship to the poet was before you set out on this quest.
Actually, I'm probably one of those few people who doesn't remember Kabir from her school days. I think growing up in India, in the Hindi classroom, almost all of us have encountered Kabir there.
Exactly.
But for me, actually, I've had a fairly irreligious upbringing in a middle-class Punjabi, fairly materialistic household. And so there was no inkling of any kind of mysticism or spirituality or belief or practice of any kind. But I think in the course of my work as a documentary filmmaker and a person who is very drawn to music, a lot of my earlier work was also in rural areas, and traveling in villages, I would often be drawn to folk music. And Kabir would pop up in those songs, and I wouldn't really understand much of it, but the odd phrase would come through, you know, strikingly. So there was, I think, a kind of a, what should I say, a beckoning long before the Godra event happened, which I think is more like a kind of, it's like a crack. I believe that these things flow like undercurrents under the surface of one's life. Various experiences of life and death and sorrow and seeking prepare you, you know, in unspoken ways, actually. And then there's a trigger, there's a crack, and the water comes gushing out upwards, you know, like a spring. But I think the preparation for that happens in subconscious ways much before that. So I think I was just getting ready to have Kabir speak to me when he did at that time in 2002.
So this line that flashed into your head, "The world has gone mad," it was just one of those lines that you heard from some rural music in villages, and it stayed with you.
Not really. That was not from rural music, but that's actually a very popular Kabir bhajan, which is "Sabz Dekho Jag Bohrana." And that popped into my head in the context of the communal riots in Gujarat, and it sort of it spoke directly to that sense of disorientation I was feeling about what was happening around me and my utter inability to really understand what was happening. But you know, these things are all connected, the inner and the outer. There is a quest to make peace within, and it sort of mirrors a quest to make peace outside. And I don't think I would have thought of it this way then, but there is an inner turbulence, right? Which we're all, as human beings, there's a quest, there's a deep angst, if you will, with which many of us, all of us, I would say, are born. And there is a seeking, and there is a restlessness, there is a yearning for something sometimes almost inexplicable. And that that desire to find solace or union or rest is a very deep subconscious call. And I think that's what mirrors our quests for peace in the outer world as well. And if there's conflict within, there is also conflict outside. And these two are deeply connected. I, of course, didn't know this so clearly back then, and I think that's what these journeys have helped me come to understand.
Sure. You know, I was also really curious about this whole six-year journey that you undertook, because the product of that, the music, the films, I think they've been so transformative, and personally for you, but then it's reached, you know, so many people and made them see and experience Kabir, and just, you know, it's like this deeper spiritual tool that we have now to, you know, kind of start seeing this othering process. But I was curious about, how did you start? And, you know, when you felt you wanted to go out, how did you start? Where did you go first? Because you went to Malwa, to Rajasthan, to Pakistan, to so many places. And how did, you know, some of your key companions join you? So could you tell us some of these, you know, could you tell us a little about that, paint a picture?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, I think my invitation to be an artist in residence at Srishti, which came from Geeta Narayanan, was just the seed, or rather it was the fertile ground in which the seed could be sowed, you know. And she invited that I join Srishti for a year. And this was straight after the riots. And when I came here, I was already churning with this question of how to respond to these, to what had happened in Gujarat. I had come away from Gujarat, but I was not, walking away from the questions that situation had created. And I had started reading Kabir through books and online, and several threads began to fall into place. And almost within a month, I began to realize that there are many, many Kabirs that I can start tracking. Immediately, I recalled my much younger 20s fascination, when I was in my 20s, fascination with Kumar Gandhar and his music. And I loved Kumar Gandharv's Kabir music, and it had been a deep desire to make films about musicians and about music itself. And I knew that Kumar Gandharv's story and his discovery of Kabir would be one strand I would like to follow. And in Srishti, I met my friend Tara Kini, who was personal friends with Kumar Gandharv's family. So that immediately became one trip we decided to do, to go to Devas and start following the thread of Kumarji. And then I remembered that I had gone to an NGO conference in Chennai, and I had met Dinesh, who worked with Eklavya, which was the NGO based in Madhya Pradesh that organized many of the Kabir folk singers, including Prahlad ji, into this forum called the Kabir Vichar Manch, way back in the 90s. And he had once met me at a conference and said, you know, we do this work with folk musicians. And I remember being very, very struck, because I, you know, working in the field of developmental activism, human rights, I would often feel a little alienated by that space on one account, which is that I felt they'd never really understood the power of culture and poetry and music. It was always relegated to the evening's entertainment, and, you know, the main space is taken up by bhashanbazi and lectures, and, you know, and I strongly felt, and now I know it for a fact, that, you know, it's not just bread that moves the human spirit, it is beauty as much that moves the human spirit. And I was very struck to hear about an NGO that was directly working with the idea of music and poetry. It's rare. So that had sort of stuck in my head, and I said, okay, Eklavya is another thread I can follow, because those were folk musicians of Kabir. So I went to Malwa, and curiously, the first person I bumped into there was this American Jew, a 60-year-old Linda Hess, a scholar, translator, lover of Kabir, who was soon to become a very dear friend of mine and advisor to my work. And I meet her, you know, bumping around in the dusty villages of Malwa. She was researching her book, which is now published as Bodies of Song. And I had just started research for the films. And I didn't meet Prahladji, actually. He was to be met, curiously, by me for the first time in the United States of America, 6 to 8 months later, when she called him there and I went there to film that tour. So, you know, these people started coming together, Prahladji, Linda, they became seminal friends and compatriots in many journeys. When I went to Pakistan to shoot with the that end of the story, Prahladji was with me. And when I was journeying into many of the Kumarji spaces, Linda was with me. So these two people, the three of us, really traveled very far and wide together. And I think those long road journeys and long conversations on trains have been the incredibly fertile journeys of intense question and answers and sharing of a lot of spirit. Mm. So those began to unfold. And and then you just follow one thread to the next. I went to Rajasthan, I went to Punjab. I had a much more ambitious plan, you know. When you start, you think you can map the world. And I said, you know, I'm going to map extant Kabir in the subcontinent and we'll do it all. And within 3-4 months of research, I quickly realized that Kabir is like a Mahasagar, you know. You can at most, Mahasagar being a huge ocean, and at most I can ek do dubki laga sakti hu main, you know, like I can wet my feet and plunge into the shores in a few places and experience Kabir and hope to experience Kabir, but I certainly cannot map through a paltry set of documentaries the scope of this man and what he means to people's hearts in this part of the world. So what also happened is that initially I had planned to do films on the manifestations of Kabir in the Guru Granth Sahib and the Sikh space, and I never reached that far because the encounter in Malwa, Madhya Pradesh, and then subsequently Rajasthan and Pakistan itself kept me so busy. I mean, it was just overwhelming. It was more than I could digest, you know, leave alone enter a whole new cultural space, which would have been the Punjab space. So that kind of idea just fell by the wayside. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful arc. And I'm glad you dipped a toe in the grand ocean of Kabir, because we all vicariously then got to dip toes as well. And so at some point you just, I guess you didn't really terribly decide that, you know, you had enough footage. I feel like there was so much more intuitive movement through this whole process. At some point you decided, I'm going to work this footage into the various documentaries, and this feels like a complete set for now. Is that how it went?
Actually, Gayatri, I just couldn't stop shooting because I was just having a good time, and I was so greedy, especially for the songs. One thing I realized very early on in my shooting for the documentary films, ostensibly, I realized I was shooting for much more than the documentary films. Subconsciously, I realized when I was traveling into the hinterlands to very, very removed villages, meeting all these people, talking to them, listening to them, I was subconsciously already recording for an archive. And I was also recording so that I could absorb these songs and start singing them. I think that was also at work because I was recording full songs and not just the flavor of a certain piece, but full songs, keeping something I think vaster in mind and recognizing that these are really jewels, these are gems, and if I don't record this, it would be such a travesty, actually. So I was shooting and traveling almost 10-15 days a month in those years, and setting out every month and coming back to home base, not really reviewing my footage, but just the hours were mounting and the mountain of footage was growing. And I think I reached a crisis point at some point. I realized I have to stop now. I really have to confront the footage and start deciding what I need to do with it and how I can craft stories from it. I think possibly delaying that was good because I was just going through so much in turmoil myself personally and going through so much transformation myself. I was not really sure I knew what to say. And I think I needed first to absorb things myself before I could share anything with the world. So yes, it was intuitive. I blew many deadlines set to me by funders. I kept going. And at some point when I started deciding to edit, that was actually a very difficult phase creatively. It took me almost a year of feeling completely at sea. I really didn't know how these four stories would emerge, and I think they eventually emerged by setting aside the logical mind, the mind that wanted to make arguments and edit things outwards in using the head. I had to set all that aside. I had to cut off the head, as Kabir says. And I had to work inwards out, you know, work with the footage, just see what I had, just see the beauty of the moments that had got recorded. And with no grand design, start working inwards out, just carving, shaping the footage, and intuitively and very associatively and laterally beginning to connect sequences with each other, again, with no grand design. And then the stories began to emerge almost like, you know, a kind of an organic growth process where when a seed becomes a tree, you don't know what shape it's going to take. So it's not like an architect where you make a plan first and then you construct the house. No. It's like a seed, and you don't know how it's going to grow. Will it be a tall tree? Will it be a round tree? Will it be a big tree or a small tree, a flat tree? Or a... So it was like that. It was quite magical and quite arduous and incredibly intense and one of the most beautiful phases of my creative life.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very, it sounds beautiful, and it was also very moving for us to hear you share about this. But, you know, the piece I'm a little curious about is this thing where you mentioned that you were recording whole songs because you maybe subconsciously felt that, you know, you felt they were jewels that were worth preserving, but at some point you started to sing Kabir songs and poetry in public. And this now singing is such an important sort of sadhana for you, such an important way to touch you know, the formless divine, I'm assuming, the Nirgun. So I was curious what, you know, and you were talking about the internal churning, so I'm just curious when the starting to sing in public piece came in this whole sequence, and did it, you know, because that must have been a bit of a difficult thing for you to do, because you were a person who's used to being behind the camera and kind of being a witnesser and recording, and to put yourself out in public. Was that easy, and you know, how did that whole thing evolve?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. So I think I've mentioned this elsewhere that in the course of these journeys, I really was itching to put the camera down and pick up the tambura, and I think that is because. I think the full power of the oral tradition hits you like a full body blow. It's like a chote. It's a wound. It's not a cerebral experience. And to receive the message of Kabir through these songs with your entire body is imperative to knowing what Kabir means. I don't know if this is sounding a bit weird, but I think if there's one of the things that I have clearly learned through these journeys with Kabir, it is to know that to show my mind its place, to know that the mind is not me, to know that the mind can be devious. And as Kabir says, man should thaghar. The mind is a looter. It's a swindler. And it can actually trap you in all kinds of mental categories that are not very helpful. And so mind and language both embed us in very unhelpful dualities. And I think music is one of the sadhanas or the ways of stepping out of those dualities and coming into a place where the body, mind, spirit become whole, become one. So then it's not about reading the poem and, you know, it's about almost, as one folk singer in an interview said, eating the poem. I think another Sufi poem talks about eating God. Many bhakti poets do that. Because, in fact, many Sufi stories, I'm currently doing research on Shah Abdul Latif Bhittai, who's a Sindhi Sufi poet, and the stories that come from that part of the world are incredible. I mean, these love legends where there are references to eating each other's flesh almost, you know, it's like Heer and Ranja or Sohini and Mahiwal, and you wonder, what is the significance of this? And it is that, you know, it's how can I make my sense of separateness from you dissolve even more completely, if not by even merging the flesh? It seems to me that that's where these Sufi stories and these metaphors of eating this poetry or eating God come from, because you have to, it has to inhabit you. That sense of separateness has to go so viscerally. So anyway, that was a long detour to say that I really wanted to sing these songs, and I felt it was important. It was just a very strong pull. And when I started singing these songs, it was with students at Srishti. They started coming home. We started having satsangs every week. And there was just incredible freedom and joy and discovery and all of that. And then I still remember Tara Kini telling me that let's do a program in Srishti for the students and the faculty. And I was so scared because A, my ego said, are you good enough? And scared because I felt I'm going to lose something as well. And I think that's what you are hinting at when you say what happens when something like this becomes very public versus something that's a more inward thing. But I think this duality is also false at some level between private and public. I think the impulse of the human spirit is to share. And certainly it is for me. I've mentioned that in the interview for this call. So it's a very interesting process. You know, I think the most profoundly moving performances are those when you sense that the singer is actually singing to herself, for herself, in an inner conversation, and you are eavesdropping, you're listening in to something very, very inner. And it's a very, it's a fragile space. It's not something you can, some artists can achieve all the time because they are extremely inward in the intensity of their art form. And that's when it, I think, touches you most. As opposed to when you are very outward as a performer and you're pandering to the audience or playing to the gallery and, you know, titillating the audience or just sort of being very outward, you know. So those are two ends of a continuum. So I think after I started singing professionally and coming onto public platforms, I have journeyed this Silhali Sigil, as Kabir puts it. It's a very tricky path. The foot slips all the time. It's not easy. Not the foot of an ant doesn't find ground to hold on this tricky, slippery path. So it's full of these kind of ego perils and parts of self-delusion and all of that has happened. And one can only just keep falling and picking oneself up and continuing. But I think I enjoy the intimate satsang the most, and I nurture that space in Bangalore, in my home, when I travel. I nurture that space very, very zealously. I also do larger public performances, but those are not my favorite spaces.
I mean, no, that's I think a beautiful reflection and very on point. But you know, connected to this, I was always so struck when I listened to Tipanya Ji in concert, when we heard when I heard Faridus and Ayaz. You know, the thing that struck me about the folk singers is sort of what I would call sort of fearless, full body singing. Like they were just, you know, their voice would like boom, and like it would envelop you so much more. And I've heard so much classical music, and I used to feel that they were so much more restricted and careful about having perfect pitch and not, you know, making any of these other errors, that their music didn't have that freedom, that power that, you know, that this sort of folk music has. And that has always been so compelling about.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because they're far less, there's that freedom, and it kind of transmits from them to the audience, like you say. And sometimes I've heard them lose their pitch, you know, but it you don't really criticize it, or you don't feel the criticism as much as you do in a classical concert, because you're also not so restricted in your experience.
And very true. That's exactly my own experience of this music. In fact, I find some of the folk music that I heard in Malwa, where Prelaji comes from, I actually think it's even the composition sometimes invite you to experience that fearlessness. You know, so the song will start by hitting the topmost pitch, wham, with the first word, literally with the first word of the song, you've hit the upper sa. No preamble, no working your way up to it. Now, what could possibly make that happen if not fearlessness? You need that fearlessness to be able to have that kind of cry. So, absolutely, there is a freedom to this genre of music, which makes it so
liberating.
I think it pierces into people's hearts, because there is that unaffectedness about it, which makes it very here and now, and in a very raw and immediate, honest space.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your Guru Shishya, your disciple relationship, as it were, with Prahlad Tipanya Ji. And I know that I've read that, you know, you said you had before the sort of general wariness of sort of hallowed Guru Shishya traditions and formal kind of, you know, becoming formal disciples and so on. But it was very liberating to have Prahlad, to accept Prahlad Tipanya as a guru, because, you know, he does believe that everyone, all of us are seekers, and your true guru is within. It would be the same formless divine that's in everybody. So I'm just curious, if you could you tell us a bit about this relationship, and what kind of guidance does he give you on your spiritual and musical journey?
So Prahlad Ji and I shared a really intense partnership, I should say, for 7-8 years, from 2003 to about 2010-11, when the energy of exchange was very intense and electric. A lot of absorbing of, I mean, at the level of Q&A, you know, I think I must have plied Prahlad Ji with endless questions in the initial years, which he very generously and humorously and graciously answered, and very, very generously opened up the whole tradition to me and his insights. But I think a guru also inspires through example or through his being, his persona. And I remember finding Prahladji's Sahajta very, very moving. You know, Sahajta is a term that you could translate as spontaneous and simple, just utterly natural, arising naturally. You know, so that lack of ponderousness, you know, I'm very suspicious of, not suspicious, but I don't groove to spiritual settings where people sit with very somber, long faces and the whole atmosphere is very, very deliberate and quiet and, you know, respectful. I like the natural, irrepressible spontaneity of humor and irreverence even, and the spontaneity of being in the here and now, of not over preparing, and of finding meaning and inspiration in the simplest of situations. And I found all that in Prahladji, just that being of his, that persona of being whole, of being one, of not preparing himself to be X in an X setting and Y in a Y setting, but just being who he is, as he is, where he is, extremely inspiring by example. And I think that a lot of that kind of helped me unwind a lot of my inner knots. And I think I absorbed a lot of that spirit from him. And I think musically, I absorbed the tradition much more in the folk idiom. In the folk tradition, I don't think I've ever seen anybody sit down for a formal class. You know, nobody even talks of doing riyaz. You just sing. Which is why when people ask me, aap kitna riyaz karte hain? I say, I don't do riyaz, I just sing, you know. Because riyaz implies that you are perfecting something towards a performance. Or maybe it doesn't. It just means sadhana. But I think musically what I absorbed from the tradition was simply by observing and being around and absorbing, osmosing it into my being while being in the tradition, in the villages for long stretches and traveling with him and performing with him and sitting and playing manjiras with him and not just him but Kalu Ramji, Kalu Ram Bamania, other folk singers from Rajasthan. And also I had the advantage of coming back with all of this in videotape and sitting here with the advantage of technology and learning the songs from the recordings. So I think musically that's been the mode of transmission, you know, led through sit-down instruction. And I think Prahladji and I are in touch, but not that intensely as that initial phase of 7 years, 7 to 10 years. Now, I think the energies shift, and there is, I think people come into orbit each other's lives with a certain intensity, and then that energy shifts. So we are not in that kind of intense exchange phase anymore, but very much friends.
Yeah, beautiful description. So, you know, I was wondering also, I do know that you went into your Kabir Project journey as an agnostic, and at some point, you know, you began to sort of believe in the concept of the divine as nirgun, as formless consciousness that pervades everything. So I was curious about that shift. Could you tell us about that?
Oops, I was hoping this question wouldn't come up. It's really difficult to speak about this. It's really, I do believe that this is an akat katha, as Kabir says. It's an untellable tale. And you almost diminish something when you put it into words. And unfortunately, the nature of language is so dualistic that anything you say falls on the left or on the right of any paradigm. And often the truth is far subtler. It could be both left and right. It could be sometimes left, sometimes right. Sometimes it could be neither. And that's much more the nature of reality than to say left or right. And I don't mean that politically. It was just to say anything on two sides of a duality.
Sure.
You know, there's the Kabir Doha to express this, which in which he says, "Haan kahun to hai nahi, na bhi kahyo nahi jai." If I say yes, it isn't so, and yet I cannot say it's no. How na ke vich mein mura satguru raha samay. My guru, or this wisdom, or this reality, lies between that space of yes and no. So when I even start to try and answer a question like this, to begin with, I feel hesitant to say I was agnostic and now I'm a believer. That somehow feels wrong. I don't think I would call myself a believer. Or you know, the words fail you. I would even hesitate to say I believe in a nirgun formless, which means do I not believe in a sagun form, path? I wouldn't say that's true at all. In fact, that's another thing, another duality that collapsed for me in these journeys, where initially I think, especially if we come from a more secular space, we approach the space of divinity, if you will, or spiritual spaces, finding the nirgun path more palatable. You know, many activists will be happy to be Buddhists because, or nirgun bhaktas, rather than a space that is more sagun, or which has a divinity with a form or a deity. I believe that duality is entirely false as well. And I don't want to privilege nirgun over sagun. I think it's all the same. You know, it's the impulse you bring to it. You can be a nirgun fanatic and you can be a very, very, very sensitive saguni, and it all doesn't matter, you know. Ultimately, it's the energy you pick up and the energy you exchange in that space. It doesn't matter at all. So again, I find it very difficult to give words to this experience. And
so maybe
maybe I would venture only as far as to say that there is a glimpse, there is a taste for dissolution of your sense of smallness and separateness from people around you, from manifest phenomena. And I think that that's, that dissolution of self and that fana that Sufis speak about, or that erasure of separation that Kabir speaks of when he says, "Lali dekhan mein gayi, mein bhi ho gayi lal." That core taste or glimpse or glimmer, whatever you might want to call it, is something that these journeys have given me.
And sure, maybe the question
is, can I just finish? Yes, and I think that taste is the closest I would come to saying, that's what I seek. I think that's what everybody seeks. Because if you don't taste that, you feel very small, very alone, very separate, very forlorn, very violent, very divisive. That's the source of all the trouble. All the divides, all the violence, all the separation comes from that sense of separateness that we have. So that's the closest I've come to being able to articulate what my understanding of faith or belief, or I don't know what you want to call it, is today.
Sure. No, I think that's it's a beautiful encapsulation. But maybe the question I thought that would more relevant to ask you then is rather what do you so when you do when you do see yourself experiencing dualities, because we're still so much anchored in these old habit patterns, say you feel, you know, a sense of moral judgment about some social injustice you read about or witness, or you feel anger or frustration, or you feel yourself indulging in othering, moral superiority, and so on. What's your practice to try and dissolve this and, you know, go back to a more sane space from which you can act?
The practice is being present in every moment. I think there is no other practice. I think that's the path even Kabir shows us, which is that you have to be alert 24/7. You have to be alert about how you are responding in situations in every moment of the day. It's not something that you can return to the luxury of a space where you do your meditation and then come back to the world. You have to be alert every moment. Aathon peher hoshiyar. So that is, I think, the only wisdom that not just Kabir, so many traditions invite us to cultivate mindfulness in all moments.
And do you find that you are capable of doing more of that as you have progressed on your journey?
No, I don't want to claim any such thing. I don't know. It's difficult to say that whether one has achieved that kind of equanimity and sensitive engagement that is not passive either. To still be engaged with the world, to be moved, to be not outraged in a polarizing way, but outraged still in a way that moves you to engage and reach out, and that is what one keeps trying to cultivate in one's life. I don't know how far one has progressed, but
So you know, the I'm also curious. So, do you feel hopeful about the world? You know, as we know it today, just the times we're living through, and you know, climate change events. So, just curious, do you feel more hopeful with a deepening of your sort of spiritual wisdom, for lack of a better word?
I don't know. I find that question very, very difficult to answer, frankly. I'm a little confused. I really don't know how to answer that question. Sometimes I feel that, you know, these waves of bad times and good times come and go, and we're just looping along in cycles in history, and the times today are not necessarily devastatingly worse than they were a few centuries ago. And at some level, I feel that all this stays in balance. There is equal measures of darkness and light at all times. Sometimes I feel like that. Now, other times I feel that things are particularly bad right now, and I feel the intensity of the pitch of divisiveness around identity seems particularly piquant right now across many cultures of the world, certainly in India. And so then I feel we are passing through bad times. And but on the other hand, I also see such incredible humanity at work in so many places. So then I feel hopeful. So I don't know. I'm confused.
Right. I think that's, I mean, basically as complex as, you know, it basically, we hold all these feelings all these responses.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I was wondering what, because I know sharing is something that you find is such a special, sharing your music, sharing one's stories to these documentary films, it's such an important aspect of your life through the web archive and so on. But I'm just curious what your thoughts are on how sharing stories or sharing music is a way to try and, you know, improve sort of collective healing of trauma in society, and, you know, just a space for releasing, you know, kind of notions, othering notions we hold. What are your thoughts on that, about the power of that?
Touching each other through stories, through emotion, through feelings, through actions is so fundamental to the human experience. And how else would we find joy and hope, and how else would we heal from whatever it is that we suffer from? You know, this is one thing I heard Prerhaji say somewhere, and it keeps coming back to me, which is, in some context he said once, that jo apne aap se jud gaya, wo sab se jud gaya. Which is that if you truly deeply connect with yourself, then you connect with everybody. And I think that sentence has such depth and so many layers of readings in it. But I feel if the depth of our sharing and reaching out and connecting to others comes from a place of having deeply connected with ourselves first, then it has all to heal, to really transform yourself and others. But if you reach out in a kind of premature, sort of half-baked or ill-judged way, without deeply connecting with yourself, then I'm not sure that kind of reaching out helps. You know, so I just feel that this has to happen hand in hand. That fundamental self-interrogation, which is the heart of all spirituality. Spirituality and this journey is not just about healing and solace. It's tough inner work. It's ugly work. It's confronting a lot of yourself and owning up to it, and also being compassionate with it. So that has to happen hand in hand with reaching out and sharing and connecting with the world and with people.
Beautiful.
Gayatri and Shabnam, I just wanted to remind folks who are listening on the live stream or on the call that you can press *6 to ask a question, because we're getting to that point where we will transition over to Q&A. Or if you're listening online, you can also use the web form or send an email to ask@servicespace.org, and we will ask your question in flow. And then just back to you, Gayatri.
Okay. You know, I was also curious about your relationship to what we, you know, think of as the concept of the gift economy or the gift ecology, which is, you know, the value around which the service space projects are all built around. It's fully volunteer run and offered to the world as a gift. And, you know, I ask also because all of the Kabir Project films are now being put on this YouTube web archive called Ajab Shahar, And so anybody can watch it without having to purchase the DVDs. So I'm just curious what inspired that decision and what your relationship to this whole idea of the gift is.
Yes. I think the idea of a gift is very fundamental to my whole experience of the Kabir journeys. I actually feel that all these experiences were gifted to me to begin with. And I therefore had the responsibility to gift it on, to pass it on. And initially we sold DVDs of the films to repatriate costs and expenses of producing, and also we channeled some of the funds into some new experiments like the rural Kabir Yatras that we started with Prahladji in Malwa and then with other friends in Rajasthan, which have now become annual features. And we seeded many of the festivals that happen around the country with initial support and funds. So that having been done and some of the funds being repatriated also to the folk singers by way of royalties, we reached a point where we felt enough. We need to just put this out now and actually not just the films. What those of you who have subscribe to the Ajab Sheher YouTube channel know that we've put out over 200 videos there of full songs that were recorded in the journeys while we shot these films. And not just the music, not just a video recording, but with subtitles, with full translation, original language, English translation, and notes. So every upload on that channel is really a labor of love. And in a month, we hope to go live with ajabsheher.org, which would be a website where all this footage gets embedded. But we offer you much, much, much more in that website. And I'm very excited to soon be able to share that work, which has been a decade in the making, actually, 9 years to date, where colleagues like Smriti Chanchani and Vipul Rikhi and myself and many other collaborators, we worked really all over 7-8 years to create this website where you would be offered almost everything we gathered in the course of these journeys. If there's anything of value, it's out there in that website for free access to the world. It has articles, it has readings from some of the articles and research that we accessed. It has interviews, in-depth interviews with people we met. It has stories of work we have done in school and college classrooms. It has a whole section called Couplets, which is a space for browsing Dohe and Bait, which are the shorter poetic forms of Kabir and Shah Latif and other poets, a space to read that muse, poetry and also listen to it, and of course the songs themselves, which when we go live would be over 150, but we would keep enriching the website as we go along because I think we have more than 500 in our archive. So, and all this intelligently tagged, not by a machine, but by us tagged in intelligent ways so that you can actually browse the site based on specific interests, whether philosophic or activist or pedagogic. You might want to know how the poetic traditions of not just Kabir but also Sufi and Baul from Bengal approach the idea of, say, the metaphor of house or ghar, and the website would allow you to browse this material with that keyword and throw up poetry from the subcontinent by diverse poets around the idea of ghar and how the idea of home or house is interrogated by a mystic poet. That's just one example. So it's a very, very rich website that we are very excited to offer as a gift to the world very soon. And I think that's the only way we can pay tribute to this tradition, because the oral traditions are gifts. The oral tradition's interaction with the market has only always caused pain and suffering and complication, actually, I should say. By and large, the oral tradition has flowed like a river, you know, and people have filled their vessels of it in different lands, wherever this river has flown, through satsang traditions and mehfils and samas. And it has been outside the market economy. It has been a gift, and people have partaken of it fully and given back to it fully. And that's the power of the tradition. So this website is the only thing we could have done to return to the tradition what we learned from it.
Beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, I agree. So beautiful. And, you know, even before this website, Shabnam, I think that just with what's gone on YouTube and the films that have come out have already touched countless people over the last decade. I mean, I feel like there's been a resurgence of interest in Kabir among the modern generation in India, which has been directly catalyzed by Linda's work and your work in traveling to these remote villages and making this work accessible. I was mentioning to you before the call that my son wouldn't be named Kabir if it wasn't for you and Linda. So it really already has touched many people. And so I couldn't help but actually ask another question before mm-hmm. we go to some of the questions that have come in. But I'm very curious about how, in your experience, your relationship with the other artists that you have touched has evolved over the course of the years, and how, in your experience, just the visibility that you've created for them has impacted the journey and the evolution of their art. Just as a personal example, I mean, I don't think, for instance, Mukhtiyar Ali could imagine that my 2.5-year-old Kabir son in California listens to Ikapalachin and the Ave, you know, every day while going to school, but he demands that I play that video on YouTube as we're driving to school. So I'm just curious what it's been like from your vantage point to see how this work has sort of impacted the entire ecology and ecosystem of Kabir and the artists involved.
I think there is no one answer to that, Rahul. I think the artists we have collaborated with over 15 years are almost, 50 or 60. Each of them has a different trajectory, a different journey, and based on their context and who they are. And I know that not all artists are as strongly grounded in the local tradition as, say, Prahlad ji is, or Mahesh Aramji is in the local tradition of, I think that also depends on not just who you are, the kind of person you are as an artist and a person, but also the kind of tradition it is. Like, I think Malwa, Madhya Pradesh, has a remarkably robust and solid oral tradition that thrives at the village level outside of commerce and circuits of professionalization, though that certainly interacts with it and influences it, and in good, bad, and ugly ways. And that is something you are seeing across the country. You would say if you meet Baul singers from Bengal, they'll speak about how much the Baul Melas have become commercialized and how earlier it was all acoustic and now it's these glaring mic systems, and all of that has happened. And it's a complex question to answer. I think some artists have become very famous and have started earning a lot of money and have got disconnected from their local contexts. Some of them have found meaning because the local context wasn't sustaining them well enough, wasn't nurturing them or their art form, and they actually found contexts for deepening their relationship with a tradition where otherwise they might be, you know, earning their money or living doing something else, not music or singing. So I think it's been a different journey for different people. I won't be able to say one thing for everybody.
Sure, makes sense. You know, one of our comments that's come in is actually from Linda, who's listening from Berkeley. She says, "Hi, Shub. Karuna and I are listening to you live in Berkeley while our dogs bark in the background. You're still inspiring me."
So hi, Linda, and hi, Karuna. Back to both of you.
Beautiful. And then we had another comment from Mish in Brooklyn, New York, who says, "Deepest gratitude for this sharing, which so deeply resonates and mirrors many of my own learnings on my long journey here. A comforting gift for my spirit and soul. Thank you for sharing yourself with us today."
Thank you.
And, you know, I'm curious on that note on how your journey and your sharing on this decade-long journey into the heart of understanding Kabir has changed your relationship with your family and your close friends. What's happened in those very sort of intimate spaces?
Well, I think my family and friends community has irrevocably been painted a distinct shade of Kabir themselves, whether they liked it or not. I make that mention in the films. When I thank various people, I say at the tail end of those credits that I thank my son, Sahir, for putting up with Kabir, because willy-nilly he grew from age 5 to 20 in the course of these journeys, and somewhere it's, I think, filtered into him whether he wanted it or not. But how has it affected or changed people? I think they've joined me on these journeys. Almost all my friends have visited Lunya Kheri with me on some trip. In the recent Rajasthan Kabir Yatra, my very close friend from Delhi, Dipta, she came along because we've spent many journeys into Rajasthan together in the research of these films. So I think sab rang gaye, as they say Hindi mein, ke they all got colored by the same hue in less or more measure.
Sure. You know, I remember having a conversation with Linda some time ago about how she walked, you know, she was walking this line of kind of being a scholar of Kabir, but in some ways the true experience is to sort of dive in and participate in the experience of Kabir. And in your question with Gayatri, where she was sort of, you know, talking about this inner shift around believing or not believing that may have occurred over the course of your journey, I was getting, you know, I was sort of interested in that that transformational element, the sort of the point of no return that occurred for you over the course of diving into this, was there a single moment where you suddenly realized that everything has changed or that something has fallen away that has given you a new sight? I'd love to hear the story of that moment, if there was a particular one.
No, I don't think so. I think it's been, I really can't think of one moment. I think it's several moments, and it's been one long journey. It continues to happen. I think the insights only get, the layers only deepen, and I really can't think of one transformative moment that suddenly, boom, enlightenment or clarity, or it's several moments. It's so many almost mundane day-to-day moments that begin to glow or light up for you with insight, insight about yourself, insight about the world. And it's several such moments over several years that constitute this this transformation.
Sure, like a gradual growing of a plant from
yeah.
many seeds. Yeah.
Yes, and it's ongoing. It's not. Yeah.
Sure, makes sense. So, given all that's happened now with the films and the website that's under works and the performance, how do you split your time these days between these various strands that all, I think, lead back to the work around Kabir? And where can people hear you perform next?
So I split my time right now between singing, writing, teaching, and archiving. These are the four things in that order. I'm trying to put writing on the top priority because I have two book deadlines coming up. And singing is always happening maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 times in a month for sure. Of late, I've begun to offer Kabir singing in Srishti to students of art and design here. And that has been unexpectedly quite a delight and a joy, because it's offered as outside of the main academic curriculum in a non-academic credited course called folk singing. And the students have begun to rock and groove to this music, and they came with me to the Rajasthan Kabir Yatra and their minds were blown, and they've begun to sing with me now, and we have begun to travel places and perform together. And in a sense, I realize what I've done is I've brought a little slice of the oral tradition into the institute, and because the class is not just about singing. As in any oral tradition, the song leads to inquiry and philosophic discussion, and the they're lured into the ideas, not just the songs. So that has become quite an interesting space of exchange for me. Of late, another very interesting thing that has begun is we are actually crafting courses that use Ajab Sheher website as curriculum. So one of my colleagues, Prashant, is crafting a course. He's a literature person, and he teaches literature in many colleges in Bangalore. And he's crafting a course called Oral Literatures, basing his class using the Ajab Sheher website as text. Because where else would you turn, at least in a classroom in a city, if you wanted to learn oral literatures, if not to something like that? And it's a great delight for us, because that's what we hoped, that this website would actually facilitate and trigger and spark things like this, which were not possible before. There is a bit of that happening. And it's the final touches and the final debugging of the website, and then we go live. But enriching the website feels like it's going to be a lifelong commitment. I often joke about this, because we have just so much stuff to put out there because we shot and recorded and archived so much, and we are. My joke about it is that when they are burying me, one hand will come out of the grave for one last hit on the button, upload, to upload the last interview or song on Ajab Sheher website. Yeah.
Is there an official launch date now for the new site?
No, not really, but watch this space, a couple of months at most.
Wonderful. I know that we wanted to create some space to actually hear one of your songs, or one of these songs, if we could.
Sure.
And obviously the acoustics are not going to be the same as if it was either in person or, you know, with a professional mic. So advanced apologies to all who are listening on, you know, a phone line or the web chat. But I think we would love to hear you sing. If you're willing to do so.
Sure. Just give me a minute to... I'm going to sing a song that I learned from Prahladji. It's a kind of a farewell song, so it fits the end of this lovely, intimate, 1.5 hour chat I've had with both of you and many of you. And Linda and Karuna can sing along because they know this song. It says, Jajo jajo re, bhai mara jajo, ina samundar par, motira lajo an bindya. So that translates as, go my friend, go across the seven seas or plunge into these seas and bring up a pearl that's unpierced or anbhinjya, that's bring up a pearl that's not wet, that's from the ocean but untouched by it. Mililio, mililio re, are you there?
Yes.
Mililio, mililio re, lambi baha pasar, abke vichyare sadho kad milanganji. Meet with each other with your arms outstretched, because once this moment of meeting passes, who knows when we'll meet again. Mil gya, moti mil gya, lakh doi char. Man ka moti re sadhu na milya. Yes, I found a jewel, and I found a million of them, but I didn't find the jewel of my heart. Ud gayi re ina ban ki chidhya, apna man darwaza phir kiya ji. She's flown away, the bird of this temple or cage, this body. She's found another home somewhere else. Pad gayi re ina maila me gaanth. Dori toote se gaanthan na chute ho ji. A knot has formed in this heart. The string may break, but the knot won't unfurl.
Mudira la jure sadho,
on a pizza all the moji na kore sadhu aur bhi jo ho all the moji na kore sadhu aur bhi jo ho
Wow. Beautiful. Thank you so much, Shabnam. Even through the audio of, you know, listening on a phone, I could just feel the sweetness of that song. Shabnam, as the host of the call, it's my privilege to ask one final question, which is, how can we as the larger service-based community support your work?
Support this work. Take it and run with it, which is to mean draw on whatever we are offering you and make more music from it. Teach it in your classrooms, organize festivals, bring it into rallies. Just fly with it, run with it, flow with it.
Wonderful. We will most certainly do that, and we'll include a link to the Ajab Shaher website when we send out the write-up that comes from this call. Gayatri and Shabnam, I know it's midnight in India, so wanted to send out special gratitude to the two of you for having such a wonderful conversation this late at night. It was a delight to be a part of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You. Thank you.
And to all our callers, we look forward to having you join us next week for the Global Awaken Call. Thank you all so much. Have a beautiful rest of the weekend.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.